Mr. Dawson, take the roll.
Senators Wardner.
Here.
Andrist.
Here.
Armstrong.
Here.
Hoag.
Here.
Murphy.
Here.
Triplett.
Here.
Representatives Porter.
Here.
Bull. Damshin.
Here.
Hanson.
Here.
Schatz.
Here.
Silbernagle.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Well, good morning, or good afternoon, I guess, since it's good to see everybody here on this nice rainy day. We got a lot of, I know out in western North Dakota, we've never been so wet. We got so much water that we're starting to wonder what's going to happen. I was looking around on the way down to see if Noah was building his boat, so much water was in the fields. With that, we're going to have consideration of the minutes of July 31 meeting. Chair would entertain a motion. Okay, we have a motion by Representative Silbernagle. Is there a second?
Second.
All right, second by Representative Damshin. Any discussion? If not, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion passes. And committee members, as you know, tomorrow we'll be here. We'll be meeting up at Bismarck State, and we'll have Mr. Dawson explain to us where we go and stuff up there later on at the end of the meeting. And we'll be taking in that energy conference up there. So with that being said, we're going to continue with our agenda item today, the 105 agenda item. Mr. Brian Kalk, Commissioner of Public Service Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We appreciate the opportunity to provide the committee an update of what's been going on at the PSC over the last, the last year since the last time we were down here to provide an update. So, Mr. Chairman, is there anything particular you'd like me to address before I go into my prepared testimony?
No, but if any of the committee members have a question about something, I know you've had some, you've been very busy. You've been out in the western part of the state. You have a wind farm hearing that you had in the southwest, and you know,
absolutely. We've seen Senator Triplett at some power line hearings as well. So, Mr. Chairman, I could probably hit through the testimony because I think that hits on some of those projects you're talking about, but I'd be happy to answer any questions as they come up.
All right, and then committee members, if you have any questions, ask them.
I'm joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchek, my colleague on the commission. Former Senator, now Commissioner Randy Crisman, is down in New Mexico at Rate School, so we're trying to get him spun up to speed. So, but he passed on his regrets for not being able to be here. And we also have a couple members of the PSC staff here in case the questions get really tough. But Mr. Chairman, just to kind of hit some of the highlights of over the last while, the Public Service Commission prepared a few pages of testimony, and I won't certainly read through all of it, but to start out with, MDU has been issued a certificate of site compatibility for an 88-megawatt gas turbine, approximately $56.6 million, over in the Heskett Station in Mandan. That's the first big natural gas peaking plant we've seen at the Commission. We've also seen some smaller ones. Basin Electric has been issued a certificate of site compatibility for two 45 megawatt gas turbines, roughly $102 million, in a Pioneer Generating Station northwest of Williston. So we continue to see more gas generation happening throughout the state. Basin Electric is also looking at two more 45 megawatt plants in the Rockford City area. So as the committee is well aware of the need for energy in the western part of the state, we've seen a lot of increased gas plants being cited and also request. We're still working with South Hart. We've received a letter of intent that they hope to have some type of plant up there of cold electricity. The last update there was the commission sent them a letter of deficiency. They've not responded back to it, so that one is still kind of in a hold pattern until we hear back from South Hart. Three big natural gas plants were sited on the state lines 1 and 2. We're dealing with One Oak, and we've seen two big expansions of the existing Hess facility for natural gas with $948 million. So big operations of natural gas going on in the state. 64 pipeline cases have been docketed in the commission, whether it's oil, natural gas, CO2, heavily involved in those. Most of those will cite, not always. A few of them require no commission action because they're below our threshold. Nine big pending cases. I'm on page 2 now, the testimony. The second paragraph, Mr. Chairman, is actually, we're going through this. This was one that really stuck out at me, that now 3.5 miles of natural gas gathering pipelines are now jurisdictional to the Public Service Commission. And I would say that this is a significant event. The commission has jurisdiction on transmission lines. We've had jurisdiction on inspections of distribution lines, but gathering lines are nothing that's been jurisdictional to the PSC. And so right away I asked our staff, how the heck does something become jurisdictional? Well, basically, if you start having facilities get within 660 feet of a natural gas line, they become jurisdictional to our inspection. So because of some of the man camps in the state, some of the growth in what we consider more remote areas, we now have some gathering lines that are jurisdictional to our gas inspection program. So we'll just have to wait and see how that impacts the program. I just thought it was very significant because normally this would not be something that we would look at, and it'll be interesting to see if this continues, because some of the big natural gas incidents that have taken place around the country are when a gas line was sited and years later you get infrastructure built on top of it, you have a big explosion, people get killed, and it's a bad deal. We've been very fortunate that we don't have much growth next to our major gas lines, but I think we're going to see more of that in the future.
Commissioner, I do have a question now. When you talk about those three new gas processing plants and expansions, how much natural gas is that going to take up? Do you have any idea? And I'm comparing it to what we're flaring now. So are we starting to eat into that?
Mr. Chairman, one of the questions that was asked during the hearing, and these, the three, I think all of them are cited around 100 million cubic feet of gas per day. And quite honestly, I really think that they're doing a good job of having a use for the gas, but as far as making a dent in what's being flared, I think with the growth of gas in the state, I don't know that it's really making a big dent, but it's reducing the amount being flared, certainly. There's just so much gas coming out. I could get some numbers for you, Mr. Chairman, to kind of put that in better perspective, but off the top, I think I'd be more comfortable with just that answer.
Okay. All right, continue. Oh, Representative Schatz.
Yeah.
Oh, Representative Andrews.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian, living up in the patch, people talk about this all the time. I've generally told people, and I'm wondering if I'm accurate on it, that we really aren't gaining on the amount of gas flared. We're picking up all the old stuff, but in the meanwhile, there's more new stuff added on. And so it's impossible to gain as long as you're drilling at this kind of pace. Is that an accurate report or not?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Andrews, you know, it'd be hard to say it's accurate because I don't have all the data put together about all this being flared as to what we're collecting. But in a general sense, I would agree with your statement that we're doing a really good job of collecting the gas for these processing plants where some of the companies are now using natural gas to make electricity. But what we've seen, though, is just the incredible growth of natural gas. It's just we need to have other uses for natural gas. And I know that MDU Resources has looked at a plan to move more natural gas to the eastern part of the state. We've seen other plans of building more generation out of natural gas. But there's a lot of opportunity for gas, but we have to have a use for it becomes a challenge, because if you capture it, you have to do something with it. And that's where the uses now are just not really there with the incredible supply.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may ask, that leads me to the second question. Are these gas gathering systems able to maximize the liquid product that can be transported? And if not, what are they doing with all that? Yeah, obviously, they're adding more natural gas in gas form than we can consume nearby. Are they able to find markets for those?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Andrews, the way I understand the state line plants and the Hess to some degree is they actually take the wet gas and break it into ethane and butane and pentane, and they have some markets for that they're finding. I think predominantly they head up west into Montana to a larger system, so I think those big gas plants are breaking it apart into different streams and finding markets for it.
And how about the, what do they call the other dry gas and the traditional natural gas?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Andrews, I don't feel comfortable answering that question. I don't know as much about the dry gas. Okay. But I could certainly find out more if you'd like and follow up on that.
I'm just wondering, didn't you remember your chemistry class back there in high school, Senator Andrews?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to find out enough stuff so I don't sound too stupid.
Oh, no. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A little bit more follow-up on the natural gas. just, we asked for and thank this committee and the members of the legislature for the additional natural gas inspector this last session, but I put some numbers in the next paragraph about the increase of miles of what we're actually inspecting for natural gas. The, getting to transmission, I'm down to the fourth bullet in the second page. We've seen 28 electric transmission line cases been docketed in front of the commission. 20 of these cases, 6 require no commission action, and 21 have been acted on. This is, the transmission growth of this last year has been significant in the Public Service Commission, where we spoke a year ago, we had a lot of things in front of us that were pending, but this last year, the commission has approved the CapEx lines, CapEx 2020 line in the Fargo area, which is huge to that region because it ensures reliability in the Fargo area that was needed in 2015 and 2016. Those were some very contentious hearings, but we got through them and given the approval and the construction is underway. Also, the Center to Grand Forks line is a big 345 line from literally Center North Dakota to Grand Forks. Those were approved by the commission and those are under construction as well, which will really open up transmission lines from the center part of the state to eastern North Dakota. We have held the hearings for Basin Electric's proposed 345 kV line from Antelope Valley looping around the south and western part of the lake up into Tioga. That's a pending case in front of the commission. I certainly won't draw any conclusions, but they were very thorough hearings, and there's certainly many issues at play in that transmission line. Senator Triplett was with many others that came up and testified. There are species concerns, historical artifacts concerns, wetlands concerns, but it's not uncommon to what we'll see in power line hearings. But this case will sort itself out, I guess. But there's certainly been a lot of discussion about that case, but it's proceeding forward. 31 wind cases have been docketed by the commission. We've acted on 21 of these. 10 pending farms in front of the commission. Of significance is the commission approved a 150 megawatt Thunder Spirit wind project just last week in Hettinger, and prior to that, Bison 4, which is a big wind farm, wind development near Center, 204 megawatts of wind power. And what's significant about that farm for Bison 4 is that's now up to 600 megawatts of wind power being generated in one concentrated area, so it's going to be a very big footprint, and who knows exactly what the capability of that area is now that the transmission is coming available. A couple things for our coal reclamation program. We received permits for additional almost 20,000 of new lines, mines to be permitted, new land to be permitted, and we're looking at final boundary lease of over 1,000 acres. I'll kind of summarize this, Mr. Chairman, to the next few pages, but we continue to reinforce the Call Before You Dig program. Thanks to this committee as well as the general legislature, we were able to increase the fine from max of $5,000 to $25,000. The goal is never to fine people, but having that as a larger deterrent certainly has caught people's attention on the Call Before You Dig program. And in my discussion with some of the national pipeline safety groups, one of the things that we may be proposing this next session is not so much the fine, but if we continue to have bad actors, that the commission has the ability to go after with the Secretary of State and maybe even take away these folks' license to operate, because we're finding that in other states that monetary, no matter how big you make it, doesn't seem to be a deterrent. And so what becomes the biggest deterrent is if the commission has the ability to go back with the appropriate agencies and just take away their license to operate. So if you continue to have folks that conduct third-party damage, they can't operate in the state. So we'll see how that all plays out. Transmission development, I hit in the big lines that are coming into play. We continue to be part of the Midwest Independent Power Provider, MISO. The FERC is heavily engaged in these regional transmission organizations, and it's been a big plus for the state to have former Commissioner Tony Clark as a member of FERC. Tony, I think, has really done a very good job of representing Midwestern concerns on FERC decisions, and there's a new chair of FERC that's going to be coming in the near future. There was a commissioner out of Colorado that he was named, Pinion was his name. He didn't make it out of committee, so they're looking for someone else. It won't be me or Tony Clark that gets that job. It'll certainly be someone from the other political party, but it'll be interesting to see because the decisions that are taking place at the FERC really affect a lot of our transmission policy. And so Jerry Leon, our staff expert, is heavily involved in that, and we continue to watch things like cost allocation and how they would bill out these major transmission projects. Pipeline safety, I touched on that a little bit. We're authorized up to 80% return from the federal government on our pipeline safety program. The number usually drops in to be 50%. I should take this opportunity. There's certainly been a lot of discussion about the recent incident that took place north of Tioga. And the commission has the jurisdiction for siting of transmission lines, whether it be natural gas or crude. And we also have a very large role in the inspections of the operation for natural gas systems, not for crude. So PHMSA, the Federal Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, is the lead for the inspections on the crude pipelines as well as this investigation as it unfolds. But we've already been in contact with PHMSA that we want to be party to this investigation as it unfolds. We've asked them to come brief us as soon as they have information, no later than a month from now, because as we go through the siting role, what we could learn out of this incident certainly could change how we do some of the siting. But what I've said publicly, and I'll say again, is my concerns now on this spill are exactly, you know, why didn't the SCADA system work the way it was designed to do? And then the notification, making sure all the agencies knew about it, we're certainly following through on that. But the key thing, I think, for this one is this the time that the state maybe look at, should we have a larger role in transmission operations for crude lines? I did some snooping around over the weekend. Minnesota has asked for some additional responsibility in this area, and I asked the question, I've got a good friend of Minnesota commissioner, about why. Minnesota is concerned because of the large number of water bodies they have, and I don't usually follow Minnesota guidance or thoughts on regulation, but it certainly does, I think, pair out to some discussion as this thing unfolds, if there is something the state should do for crude oil transmission. We don't have a high history of incidents with crude pipelines, but this one will certainly, I think, catch a lot of people's attention. So that's something that I'd like to discuss with my colleagues in the commission, and maybe at some point in time have a larger discussion with the committee. Okay. The closing up, advanced determination of prudence was something that the commission was authorized to do a few years ago. Companies can come in and ask that a project is prudent before it's actually built. We continue to be heavily involved in those. And the last thing is we've seen 14 electric service area agreements where, whether it be two co-ops come in front of the commission or an investor owned in a co-op trying to define service area boundaries. I think that's been very helpful because they're able to figure out a solution what they want for their service area boundaries. We can approve it when it's a non-controversial issue, and it really sets the footprint going forward of who's going to serve in what area. So subject to your questions, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Okay, committee members, questions? Representative Silveringel.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kalk, is there anything on the horizon relating to transportation fueling facilities using natural gas or any of their byproducts anytime soon in North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Silveringel, I'm unaware of any, but I will tell you that I don't believe the commission has a jurisdiction on that, because most of these, the way I understand them, would be below the siting threshold for the changing of gas. We've had some questions before about uses of natural gas to fertilizer, and those came in at a level below the threshold. So if they were very large facilities, they may come under our jurisdiction, but I've not heard of any, and I don't, if they're smaller, they probably wouldn't fall under our jurisdiction.
Senator Andrist.
Mr. Chairman and Brian, concerning the pipeline leak, and maybe this isn't a fair question for you that you can answer, but and I would understand, but the report on that leak was this was an older 25-year-old pipeline, I think it was, and they found a hole in it that they blamed for corrosion. Is corrosion a significant problem as these pipes age? And if not, do they have a lifespan? We always, you know, accidents happen, but we always look for ways to prevent them from reoccurring if we can.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Andrus, when pipeline incidents occur, if you look at the data, the first biggest cause is third-party damage. Somebody hits it when they shouldn't be doing it, called for a dig. And then after that, it gets into a little layering, but corrosion is a big deal for pipelines. I know that for natural gas pipelines, corrosion tends to be the key thing that can cause problems. They're very, very thorough about their corrosion control programs, very thorough about sending the pigs down the line and making sure they've got the right, I think they call it cathodic protection on corrosion. And so we'll just have to wait and see what the PHMSA investigation bears out, but the initial report that I saw from PHMSA, it pointed right to potentially corrosion being part of this. So I think that as the investigation flares out, we'll have to look at and see when was the last time that the pipeline was inspected for corrosion, when was the last time that PHMSA reviewed the records, But to answer your question, I guess more directly, is that there's something that causes fill. And if somebody didn't hit a third party, it almost always comes back to some type of operation or maintenance. And whether this was preventable or not, I think, is what we'll need to learn in the PSC going forward for siting. But in my experience with PHMSA, what they'll do is they'll do their full investigation. They may levy a monetary fine. They may do a corrective action plan where they ask this, this, and this of the company. So this is certainly a big deal, but it's going to have to play itself out, I think.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Kalk, also in regards to the oil spill with the pipeline just off of Tioga, there seems to me to be two levels that are being discussed, what you were just speaking to, the prevention and how this happened. And the second one that seems to have made, I don't need to tell you or probably anybody in this room, a lot of headlines, not just in the state, but starting to make some national, was discussion about response time. Now, forgive the anecdotal nature of my question. I read in the Bismarck Tribune, and what I've read in a few other papers, then what I heard from Mr. Jansen, the landowner who noticed said spill, when he was on Joe Heitkamp's show on KFGO last week, seemed to differ. So I wanted to ask you, when he reported the finding of the spill to the state, I don't know to whom he reported, but it got to the health department as they were the ones covering it, how long did that take to get to you? Was it 24-ish hours, or did it take the 12 days, as it has been reported in some places?
Sure, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, try not to get too far ahead of myself of what our role here in this is, but I think my role partly is to keep the public trust and confidence in pipelines. And so the Public Service Commission was first notified Thursday of the pipeline incident from PHMSA, from the federal agency. So that is a little uncommon for us. Usually PHMSA gets us notification right away. So why exactly PHMSA didn't give us the notification ahead of time, we've certainly asked to them why that delay took place, whether it was because they didn't have the people in place, that's all strictly, I don't know. But in conversation with, I think Dave is up, Glad is up, he could next talk better, I think, to the response time, but in my brief discussion with the health department and the company, what is good, I think, is that my understanding is once the farmer notified the company did the right thing, they reported to the National Incident Center. The health department was out there very quickly, so there wasn't, in my understanding, there wasn't a delay in people getting out there starting to do the work. There was a breakdown and delay of notification, and we're not an action agency, but the awareness of it certainly is important, so we can start to be included in the process of finding out what happened. So I don't know if that answers your question. The Public Service Commission was notified last Thursday from PHMSA what happened. That was our official notification.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Clark, just a quick follow-up to that. I heard you when you say that you don't, your agency does not have the primary inspection or even any inspection role regarding crude oil pipelines. But maybe Mr. Glad is a better person to ask, but just before you leave the podium, to the extent that you know, what is the frequency of monitoring on those for the company? I mean, I understand the companies are supposed to fly those lines and make sure there aren't spills. Do you know how frequently they do that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Triplett, I would be just conjuring the exact numbers because I don't control the frequency of inspections on that. But there is definitely a protocol of how many times they're supposed to fly the line, how many times they're supposed to run the pigs down them. I would caveat, though, Senator, that the Public Service Commission could have a play on a crude spill if it turned out it was because of a violation of call before you dig. And so if someone was out there and hit this crude line with a backhoe, there would be the PHMSA look at it, but then we would also have some jurisdiction because we enforce the call before you dig portion of the Century Code.
Anyone else that has a question? Senator Hogue.
Commissioner Kalk, I wonder if we can go back to that Thunder Spirit wind project. I happened to catch some of your deliberations online last week, and I heard that, you were talking about a Supreme Court decision, and I know Commissioner Fedorchak was talking about a 10% standard for renewable energies, and I'm wondering whether you think that there's adequate legislative guidance to the Commission on siting these large wind turbine projects.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoag, I think we have adequate guidance to cite these things. I think the question going forward is that, and I won't speak for Senator Crispin or Commissioner Crispin, but I think that one of the things that became front and center in that Hettinger wind farm is that the commission has a responsibility for citing wind farms, and I think that's very clear. But one of the things that it was a 2-1 vote. So when my colleague was looking at it, was looking at the component of need. Do we determine need? And then before I go back to in previous Supreme Court decisions, need was not, was someone tried to bring up that need was a factor that we should look at, and that the court then said, no, need is not a factor. It's you strictly look at citing. We really look at need in a rate case down the road. So in my mind, it's very clear. But I believe that Commissioner Crispin and Commissioner Fedorchak is here. He was looking at the sense that since there was a 10% goal, he thought that that might have weighed things differently. And so that's something I think that perhaps better for him to answer. But for me personally, I'm very comfortable with the laws that are in place. The Hettinger wind farm was extremely controversial at the county level because the county wanted more restrictive setbacks, and the commission was headed down there for a hearing prior to the county setting up its own setbacks. And so we basically pulled back and said, we're not going to go down there for a hearing until the county lays out whatever setbacks they want, and they end up with a setback of 2640, which I'm happy to comply with, because unless we have overwhelming reason, I certainly would want to follow the county's guidance because it's in their area. So I think there was a couple different components at play, but your question, I'm comfortable with the laws the way they are now.
Anyone else have a question for Commissioner Kalk? Well, thank you for that update. I personally appreciate it. Well, let's move on to our next agenda item, the 135, and we have Mr. Dave Glatt from the Department of Health. Dave, welcome to our committee.
I can speak louder too. Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the Energy Development and Transmission Committee. My name is Dave Glatt, Chief of the Environmental Health Section for the North Dakota Department of Health. The department has responsibility for the implementation of many of the environmental protection programs in the state of North Dakota. I'm here today to provide you with a brief description of the current status of carbon dioxide regulations being proposed by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and update you on our evaluation of the existing state regulation, which addresses technically enhanced naturally occurring radioactive materials, also known as TNORM. As part of his overall climate action plan released on June 25, 2013, President Obama laid out a directive to the US EPA to establish power sector carbon pollution standards for new and existing power generation facilities. In the first phase of the plan, and as provided for under Section 111B of the Clean Air Act, the emphasis will be to establish carbon emission standards for new power generation facilities. Section 111B is a federal program designed to address new, modified, and reconstructed sources by establishing standards of performance. On September 20th, 2013, the EPA proposed carbon emission limits for new electric generation facilities as follows. They looked both at natural gas and also coal. Under the natural gas-fired stationary combustion turbines, large natural gas units, those greater than 850 million BTUs per hour, the limit would be 1,000 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. For the smaller natural gas units, those less than 850 million BTUs per hour, we're looking at 1,100 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. EPA believes that the new natural gas-fired stationary combustion turbines can meet the proposed standard without the need for add-on control technology. As we looked at fossil fuel-fired boilers and integrated gasification combined cycle units, these performance standards are based on the performance of new efficient coal units implementing partial carbon capture and storage, or CCS. Two limits are being proposed depending upon the compliance period that best suits the unit. For if you look over a 12-month operating period, the limit would be 1,100 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. And if they want a little more flexibility and over a longer time period of an 84-month operating period, the limits would be lower of 1,000 to 1,050 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. The longer compliance period option is believed to provide flexibility in operation by allowing facilities to phase in the use of partial CCS. For comparison purposes, the current fleet of coal-fired electric generation facilities in North Dakota emit an estimated 1,800 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour to approximately 2,400 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. EPA believes that with current and planned technology, implementation of CCS projects combined with the availability of geologic storage sites, that the technology is available to meet the proposed standard. The state is looking at the proposal and will be providing comment within the 60-day comment period. One of our initial concerns regarding this proposal is the cost and long-term viability of some of the technologies being proposed. Typically, a period of operation of a full-scale facility is desired to determine if, in fact, the technology is feasible and available, especially when lignite coal is used as a feedstock. The second phase of the Climate Action Plan will address CO2 emissions from existing power generation facilities under Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. Section 111D is a state-based program for existing sources where EPA establishes the guidelines and the states design the programs to fit the unique circumstances of that state. EPA is on schedule to propose the 111D guidelines by June 2014 and is intending to make them final by June 2015. That's a very aggressive schedule if you know rulemaking and how that goes. Because of the state lead nature of the statute, EPA is engaging in extensive stakeholder outreach seeking input on the various carbon reduction options and approaches available to states before making any proposals. EPA is currently emphasizing flexible and pragmatic approaches needed to reduce carbon pollution from existing emission sources. The state is evaluating how to approach this new rulemaking process by considering the following. How do we bridge the environmental protection control investments of the past to new carbon control investments in the future? How do we develop a state carbon reduction strategy when we acknowledge the regional multi-state nature of the energy producing organizations? What credit should be given to technologies that reduce carbon emissions that have already been implemented by electric generation facilities? How do we acknowledge and reconcile the state and regional economic impact of a carbon control strategy? Should we explore the potential for averaging carbon emissions from all energy production facilities, which include wind, hydroelectric, solar, coal, natural gas, and nuclear, when we consider total energy production and from that establish a pounds of CO2 per megawatt produced? Finally, how will a strategy address states with increasing energy demands now and into the future? A very complicated issue when we're looking in North Dakota that we're running short of energy with the oil field development. How do we address that? These are just some of the questions being evaluated by the department as we move forward addressing the issue of federal climate action plan. It is important to note that not all states are in agreement with the federal climate action plan. Some see it as too limited and desire significant movement forward in controlling carbon emissions, while others see it as an overreach of the federal government having a significant impact on the local economies. We anticipate that the final path forward will include a combination of what the technology will allow, cost of implementation, and policy decisions relating to how the state will move forward in the development of its energy sources. And I'll stop there before I get into the radioactive to see if you have any questions as it relates to the climate strategy.
Okay, committee members, any questions, comments on the CO2 being regulated by the EPA? Senator Armstrong.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Glatt, current and planned carbon capture technology, is this proved out? I mean, carbon capture is they put it back in the ground, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, they can do that. They can use it for enhanced oil field recovery and for other uses. So that's one, is to sequester it into the ground.
Okay. So I guess my follow-up question to that is, when we deal with either extracting things out of the ground or putting things under the ground, do we have anything in current law for, like, those types of things as to how we would implement that, or is that something we will have to add to North Dakota law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, and that's a good question, and we do, as it relates, you know, North Dakota sits in a pretty good geological spot as it relates to sequestration of CO2. We have formations that are large, an aerial extent, large and just mass, and they can accept a lot of CO2, and there's been studies done by EERC as relates to how we can go about doing that, and there's been some good information relating to that, and there's actually been some activity, pilot studies that show that that can be done. In addition to that, Oil and Gas Division has established rules as it relates to what they call Class 6 wells, and that relates with how do we go about monitoring, constructing wells, just the whole regulatory aspect of regulating the injection of CO2.
Thanks.
I do have a question. Going back, let's say, to 1990 to the current time, our current coal generation plants, do you have any idea how much they've brought down the CO2 emissions over that time?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much they brought it down, but I know they've, just by becoming more efficient in burning coal and maximizing the amount of energy that you get output from a power plant with the amount of coal you get in, you're just reducing the amount of coal you have to burn. So efficiencies in the plant will bring down CO2 emissions. And that's what we're thinking, is that, you know, the technology to retrofit into existing plants is sketchy at best and extremely expensive, but to maximize the efficiency in your plant. And I would imagine a lot of the coal facilities are doing that now. They want to get the most return on their investment and make their plant as efficient as possible. So the efficiency in itself will drop the CO2. The amount, I couldn't tell you right offhand. Okay. I might be able to reconstruct that over the years, but if you'd like, we can take a look at that.
And then the technique of drying the coal, the lignite coal, now that's an efficiency, and I would guess that has had a big impact on CO2.
Mr. Chairman, it has had an impact, and that's where one of the questions is that, you know, there's some, you know, GRE has developed this technology and has done coal drying. Should they be given credit for what they've done years ago as we move forward to CO2? That was clearly had a CO2 impact by reducing the emissions. And so we believe there should be some credit given for that.
Then the question would be that if it looks like, 2015, these things have to be in place?
Mr. Chairman, that's what they're shooting for, but in recent history, I have not seen EPA hit a target date because of the lawsuits, and just the number of comments they're going to get on this are going to be huge. There's also the discussion on how much authority does EPA have in this area, and that's a legal question. I'm not an attorney. I don't claim to be that smart, but they're trying to figure out, does an executive order from the president going under the Clean Air Act, do the states have to follow it? And some states are just going to say no and see what happens in court.
Well, my question would be, what happens to our current plants? Do they cease to exist, or do they have a time period after 2015 to come into compliance?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's all going to depend on what comes out of those regulations. EPA has told us that they are going to be extremely flexible and acknowledge that, and we've had discussions, like states like North Dakota, they talked about establishing a baseline. Well, how do you establish a baseline in North Dakota when your energy needs are going like this? Any baseline we establish, say 2005, we're already in the hole. We're not going to be able to meet that. And so we've had those discussions. They say they're going to be flexible. They want to listen to the states. I believe we need to get input to EPA. The eastern states are getting input into EPA right now saying, hey, sea levels are rising. We need to cut this now. Let's get to it. The energy producing states are going, well, we're in a different paradigm here. We're producing energy for the nation, yet we're going to be penalized at the local level. And so we need to look at this differently and have more flexibility as we move forward. Not saying that we won't reduce carbon dioxide emissions, but we need to have that time flexibility so we don't, because as we stand here now, it's my understanding we need coal-fired energy. We need everything on the table. We can't start pulling things off. It's interesting, I made that comment in a large forum when all the states were there, and Oregon made that comment and said, well, wait a minute. If you shut down North Dakota, not that they get energy from us, but they're an energy receiving state, that has an impact on us. They see that we just can't shut down plants, that there has to be a transition. How long that will be, I don't know.
Okay, thank you. Senator Triplett.
Senator Wardner and Mr. Glad, your second to the last bullet point on the first page is interesting to me about the potential for averaging carbon emissions from energy production facilities. And I guess I'm just wondering if there's been any discussion along the lines that, you know, that our coal-fired power plants are really located so close to the oil patch that there's a really obvious connection there between using carbon capture from the utility plants for enhanced oil recovery. Now, enhanced oil recovery may sequester a piece of the carbon, but some of it comes right back up again as part of the recovery process. Is that kind of what you're thinking of when you're talking about the averaging piece, or is that a whole different question?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, and this will be kind of my abstract thinking, so bear with me, is that we're looking for that bridge from the investments we've had today to the investments of what we want to see in the future. One way we can do that is what we want to encourage companies, still they can use coal, but we want to encourage them to use renewables, wind, hydro, solar, those type of things. If we take their entire fleet of energy producing sources, whether it be coal, wind, hydro, look at the megawatts they produce, look at the total, all of those together, what the CO2 they produce, then average that, put that together, and come up with a limit. So as they move forward to invest, they look at, okay, if we invest heavily in renewables now, we might be able to burn more coal in the future, or burn it in a different way. So it's trying to look at their entire fleet, and they're not all in North Dakota. And so that's the method to that madness.
Okay, so you're talking there about a sort of a company by company average, and I guess I was talking more about sort of the whole energy portfolio within the state, that if you use carbon capture from the coal-fired utilities and they sell it to the oil industry, and therefore it helps the oil industry to be more efficient, which is also a benefit to the national security of the country and all that sort of thing, and maybe they get credit for that even though it's not technically carbon capture if the oil industry is going to let part of it come back up again on the upswing.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Senator, as an energy producing state, I think our paradigm is a little bit different. We need to look at the complexity of all that. It isn't just North Dakota coming up with a plan, because we impact many states in the region. And so we need to take a look at the totality of how energy is produced, how we distribute that, and then how we can, through that knowledge, how we can start reducing our carbon emissions. And so it's a complex issue that I don't have all the answers to.
Okay. Anyone else? Senator Andrus, and then Representative Hansen.
Dave, I apologize for this question if it's out of your realm, but I'm hoping somebody here can answer today. The alarm bell that rang for me wasn't the fact we had that pipeline leak north of Tioga, but it might be attributable to corrosion. And there are so many new pipelines going in, and I'm thinking down the road, if somebody can talk about corrosion in pipelines, is that going to be a big issue as the years go by?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I am not the best person to talk about as it relates to pipelines, but just facilities in general. As they age, you have bigger challenges on maintenance in making sure that the integrity is there, and that's why you have monitoring activities, smart pigs, if you will, or pressure sensors to just kind of keep an eye on it. I will tell you that we've had in gasoline stations brand new pipe distribution lines put in that will leak within 6 months if they're installed improperly. And so it comes down to the construction, the design, construction, installation, and then maintain monitoring. And if facilities grow older, there's a higher probability that there's something will happen. So that's the only answer I can give to you. Other people look at that and we don't.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. and it is pronounced Glatt?
Yes, or Glatt. All right. AU works.
If I can get it right. Mr. Glatt, in the as as proposed right now, the power sector carbon pollution standards by the president does not include the ability to provide for adjustments by the individual states?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the proposals out now relate to new construction. So any, as we move forward, I would venture a guess, you're not going to see the type of facilities being built in the future that we see here today. They're going to be looking at more of capture systems, turning coal into natural gas and burning it, those type of things. So, as we move forward, they're going to have to meet these stringent emission limits. For existing plants, the jury's still out. They haven't identified what those emission limits would be.
I had a quick follow-up.
Continue.
Thank you. And then you had also mentioned that there were some states, including potentially North Dakota, that were going to try to lobby for a little, you know, making it a little bit more state by state. If that were to occur, do you know if that would be under the jurisdiction of the Department of Health or legislative jurisdiction, or what that would fall under?
As Mr. Chairman, Representative, as stands now, the department has a responsibility for the Clean Air Act and implementation, so it would fall under the Clean Air Act. Clearly, though, as we get into these kind of issues, the EPA administrator said she could live with 50 different plans. Talks cheap. I don't know if she's going to live with that. But on the same token, you know, we may be similar to Wyoming and some of those other energy producing states. There may be a benefit of having a regional plan that includes other states. I don't know. You know, I've talked to some of my counterparts in other states and said, what do you think about this? And states are really reluctant to give up any sovereignty. But in something like this, if you're looking at what's the best way to deal with an energy industry looking at carbon reduction, we may want to be looking at a multi-state compact or something to that effect. I throw that out as an idea. That may take some legislative directive.
Okay. I was just about to ask, that would be then done by a legislative directive or by your department in other states?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I assume it could be. You know, we're still in the preliminary stages of looking at this, and we're looking for a lot of input and to see which way we should go.
I was interested in your one comment when you talked about changing the coal to gas and then into gas power generation for electricity. I suppose that would be because they can capture the CO2 much easier that way, such as our Great Plains sin fields.
Mr. Chairman, as a matter of fact, they use that as an example that the technology is there and you can make it happen. The issue that is the cost of those plants, and then if you're in the business of taking coal, converting it to natural gas prices may make that cash flow kind of hard, you know, for that plant. And so those are the issues that you would have to look at. But the technology is there to do that.
Okay. Representative Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Glatt, in the 80s and the 90s, there was a lot of discussion, especially in the Pacific Northwest, about carbon credits. You have not mentioned that term, but yet carbon credits were one of the things that was identified as those plants that were such at the point where they could not be rehabilitated, where those plants could go forth and purchase those carbon credits. You not mentioned that. Is there a reason?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no reason. It's just I just hadn't mentioned it. You know, I know that when you look at the landscape now, you don't hear as much talk about that. It's more of carbon capture, the physical process at the plant, and that's where I think a lot of them are going. But I think that's still an option. It could be put on the table.
Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Glatt, I would like to, I was thinking about what Representative Schmidt was talking about earlier when you talked about a regional approach. And if possibly, if we're looking at carbon credits, could that be spread over the region? Is that one of the advantages that you guys were thinking about?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I do think there's some advantages going over the region. You know, you have an energy producing corridor as you go straight from North Dakota all the way down to Texas. You know, you got Oklahoma, you got Wyoming, you know, you can bring in Texas on that. They're all producing energy. They have coal, natural gas. Maybe there's a benefit of having states get together and develop their plan. We know that the East Coast is doing that, and there's strength in numbers. And we may want to, we have more in common with these center states than we do with the East or West Coast. And maybe that's some of the conversations we should be having.
Okay. Anyone else? Continue.
continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. T-Norm regulatory developments. The state currently regulates the storage and disposal of technically enhanced naturally occurring radioactive material, or T-Norm. T-Norm is generated from the physical process of concentrating norm during oil field activities. Norm is just naturally occurring radioactive materials without the T on it, during oil field development. T-Norm can be found in many areas, including filter socks, pipe scale, or sludge found in tank bottoms. At present, the state generates significant quantities of T-Norm generated from oil field development activities necessitating special handling and disposal. In North Dakota, T-Norm can be defined as any material from oil field development that exhibits a radioactive concentration of 5 picocuries per gram. This concentration is considered very conservative and may be close to background conditions. Pursuant to state rule, any material that exhibits a radioactive concentration above 5 picocuries per gram should be transported to a facility approved to handle such waste. At present time, disposal facilities of this nature can only be found at out-of-state locations. Industry and environmental groups have asked the state to evaluate the standard handling practices and determine if current record keeping is sufficient to address T-Norm in the state. To determine if the T-Norm standard is appropriate, the department will be conducting the following activities. A contract between the department and the Argonne National Laboratories designed to research, model, and report on the environmental and public health risks associated with the generation, transportation, storage, and long-term disposal of T-Norm may be signed in the near future. The study is anticipated to be completed in the middle of next year. The department will collect representative samples from oil field development activities to determine the range of potential T-Norm concentrations and the quantity generated in North Dakota. We will evaluate how best to monitor and track the generation and disposal of T-Norm in the state. The results of the evaluation will be used to determine if the existing T-Norm standard and waste tracking methods are sufficient to address the amount of waste being generated in North Dakota. Based upon the current timetables, we're expecting the study and standard evaluation to be completed by next summer. This concludes my testimony. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions on the radioactive material, the T-Norm? If not, thank you, and thank you for, oh, I'm sorry, Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Glatt, have I been mispronouncing your name all these years? Glatt?
I've called a lot of things. No, you've done well.
Okay. excuse me. When you say that there is a significant amount that we have are currently generating, can you quantify that?
Yeah, we're in the process of, Mr. Chairman and Senator, we're in the process of doing that. You know, I've heard a lot of numbers thrown out there. Best guess, and that's the really ballpark, is maybe 10,000 to 15,000 tons a year, maybe. But that's one of the things that we're doing as part of this study, is how much actually is generated and from what are the major sources. Right now, because we're a fairly new oil field, they're filter socks, and I'm sure you've heard a lot about filter socks. But as the oil field ages, we'll be looking at other things like pipe scale. We'll look at other things like tank sludge and tank bottoms. That will all accumulate, and that will exhibit a radioactive element.
And if I may continue, Mr.
Continue.
To what extent do you think you have a handle on where the 10 to 15,000 tons per year is going right now?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, we believe that the vast majority of it is going to Colorado. Some of it's going to Montana, and then some is also going to Texas. But that's one of the things we want to track as well. I think some of it is being improperly handled and disposed of, and that's one of the things we want to look at is the tracking process, cradle to grave. You know, should there be a better process to do that? It's my understanding that Louisiana has a very good tracking process, and we may want to take a look at Louisiana to see if that works for them and they know where it goes.
So at the present time, we don't have an adequate tracking process then, is that fair to say?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I would say we don't have a tracking process. You know, they don't have to report it to us. I would say the good companies are keeping records because they just want to know where it goes, but they don't have to report that to us. Okay. Mr. Chairman, any questions on the oil pipeline break? I can give you a rundown on that.
Yes, would you do that? There's a lot of people have a lot of questions.
Well, there's been a lot going on, and I will tell you the department's involvement in how we were addressed it. I can give you a timeline. On the evening of September 29th, after 10 o'clock in the evening, that was a Sunday evening, we were notified through the DES process, and kind of where this goes is they are required, responsible parties are required to report within 24 hours if of their identification of a spill or a leak to state radio or to the department. They went to state radio. State radio contacted us plus other people. We had people on site the next morning evaluating. At that point, it was identified as a 750 barrel spill. Staff were out on site. We gave a burn variance. It was diked, and they did a burn variance. And after the burn was complete, staff looked at it and said, you know, you need to do some more assessment here. This doesn't look right. So the company were very cooperative. They moved ahead and started the assessment. The assessment included test pits, monitoring wells, soil borings to try to delineate the extent. On the afternoon of Tuesday, the 8th, after 4 o'clock, field staff were notified by Tesoro that the estimate had changed. Based on the extent of the contamination, using some calculations, looking at the porosity, they felt that of the soil, they felt that the release was more in the 20,000 barrel range. The staff found that out, and actually they were going that evening, they were going to a criminal case. They redirected their movement and went back to the site the next morning. Looking at what were the issues related with the environment. I want to be clear that the 20,000 barrel spill was not good. It was terrible. We don't want that to happen. However, if this were ever to occur someplace, where it did is probably the best place it could have occurred. It's on a slight rise. There's no groundwater associated there. And there's a very fat clay barrier at about 10 to 14 feet below the surface. So it contained it in that area. And it's oil. Oil is a lot easier to clean up than salt water. And so I think there are some positives here in a very bad situation. Where we're at now, we had people on the site on Wednesday, last Wednesday, working with the company. We had people there over the weekend. Where we're at now is looking at a remediation plan from the company. We want to know how they're going to clean it up. And quite frankly, I want to sit down with the company and say, okay, how did we get to this point? How do you operate your facility? How did we get that release? And how did so much get released until we found it? And I think the company's been very forthcoming on that, and we'll be sitting down and discussing that issue with them.
Well, the question I would have, it wasn't reported right away because it was thought that it was a small spill. Is that my understanding?
It was 750 barrels, and that's not a small spill. That's a considerable amount, but it was inside a bermed area, diked, and there was no surface water being impacted. There was no public being exposed to it, so it was contained. And that's what we look at: is it contained? I will tell you that you can get a 50 barrel spill that has significantly more environmental impact if it gets in waters of the state than what we've seen at this so far. And I want to be clear that we're continuing to evaluate and assess all the damage that has been conducted or has happened, but we know that where it is and where it isn't, and we know that it's contained through some diking and also some trenches, recovery trenches they have in place, and we will be looking forward to a complete remediation plan here in the near future.
Well, I guess, from everything I've read and from what you're telling me, I think everybody realizes that you jumped on this thing right away and you took care of it, you made sure that it didn't spread. The only question is everybody's asking how come it didn't get reported sooner, and
Mr. Chairman, in that
have an answer for that. Or
I will
not.
Tell you that, and thank you. I think we did respond following the law, and we complied with the law, and staff were right on top of it from day one. Staff's first priority is protection of public health and the environment, and dealing with the issue in front of them, and they've done an excellent job doing that. What we need to work on I'll also say is that when DES gets notified, they notify the local emergency managers. When we had a burn there, we have to notify the local fire department. So people were engaged in this, but not to the level some people would like us to have that. I think with lessons learned, we need to do better getting that communication from the folks in the field up the ladder so that can be disseminated quicker. At no time was the department negligent in responding to this. How we get that information out to the public, we're looking at how we can do a better job of doing that, and I think we should.
Okay. Representative Schatz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Glatt, how old was the pipeline that broke?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, it was in that 20-plus years. I think it's a significant, it's an age. I don't know if that's old for a pipeline. I'm not a pipeline guy. We just deal with the mess afterwards, and we don't deal with that many messes from pipelines, which is a good thing. But when they do occur, they can be significant. I don't know the age. I'm sorry.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Glatt, I guess I'm less concerned about whether your office staff called the governor than I am about how long it took for the company to figure out there was a problem and how they figured it out, which was by a local landowner. I mean, can you talk about what level of monitoring is going on either by the company or by the federal agency and why they didn't figure it out earlier?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, and I think that's going to be part of the investigation. You know, that those are questions that we will be asking. Those are the questions that the PSC will be asking, is that why did it take this? Are there safeguards that should have been placed that weren't? Are there safeguards that they weren't required to do that they maybe should have had? You know, those are things that we're going to have to, they'll come out in the investigation, and that we will take forward with us as we look at other pipelines and how things are done in the state.
Anyone else? Senator Andrews.
Just a quick one. Mr. Chairman, Dave, it may be a non-fair question. Would anybody have an idea how long this had been leaking?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I think, you know, we're going to have to, hopefully that will come out in the investigation. You know, I think it has to do with the pressures within the pipe, what kind of product was moving through there, the soil types, and we might be able to figure out how long that had been leaking. My understanding, there was pretty significant pressures in that pipeline, so it may not have been that long. I don't know. But that's what we need, some of the answers we got to get from the company.
Okay. Anyone else? Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We're gonna go one more before we take just a short break. So Mr. Justin Kringsted is on to talk about pipelines. Nice segue. So you heard all the questions, Justin. I hope you have answers.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Justin Kringsted, Director of the North Dakota Pipeline Authority. I've got a set of slides here that we'll run through, and then we can discuss anything from the presentation or any other questions that the committee may have. Just an update on what has been happening over the past year or so in the pipeline industry. You've seen this figures for 2011 and previous. We just received the 2012 numbers. We had over 2,400 miles of new pipeline put into service in 2012. Again, you can see the distance there, roughly LA to New York. And so when people ask if pipelines are getting installed in Western North Dakota, you can give them a resounding yes. And you can imagine the number of crews, the landowners impacted by this pace of development, and it's phenomenal. And we expect this type of activity to continue now for the next number of years to come as we get more gas gathering put in the ground, more liquids pipelines as well. So we'll start with crude oil very quickly. We're going to look at production, how that crude oil is being moved, and what the market conditions are doing. On the production side, not any drastic changes in my oil forecast expectations for the region. Again, somewhere peaking around that 1.4 to 1.6 million barrels a day in the early 2020 time frame. How we're moving our crude oil, again, I always break it down by two primary challenges. Number one, getting oil out of the Williston Basin, and challenge number two, moving crude oil within the Williston Basin. And we'll take a look right away at challenge number one. So our three major pipeline systems currently operating, we still have Enbridge up in the northern tier of the state moving crude oil east towards the Great Lakes. They have 355,000 barrels a day of total capacity. We have the Tesoro refinery in Manan at 68,000 barrels per day. And then we have the Butte pipeline system, which moves crude oil south into Wyoming and then east towards the Great Lakes as well. 22 rail facilities currently operating in western North Dakota. We have a handful of others either in the development or construction phase for the state. You can see that as of this summer, those rail facilities are moving over 600,000 barrels of crude oil per day, somewhere around that 640 to 650,000 barrels a day moving by those 22 rail facilities. So we did see some leveling off this summer, primarily because of market conditions, and we'll touch on those here in just a second. Just the market share breakdown, now around 64% of the crude oil moving by rail and the remainder moving by pipeline to those mid-continent refining centers. And what's happening, again, historically on that market share, you can see here the three major transport systems. We either have the refinery located here in North Dakota in blue on the bottom. We have our pipeline systems in green. You can see that starting in 2012, the rail economics started to erode away volumes off of our pipeline system. We historically would have believed that pipelines were going to remain 100% full. Anything above and beyond that was going to go on rail car. And that shifted in 2012 when barrels started moving off the pipelines towards the rail system, again, because of some favorable economic conditions moving those barrels by rail. So now we'll switch gears to the more localized crude oil gathering. This challenge number one, again, how do we get these fluids off the roadways, the water, the crude oil, and into pipeline systems to, again, ensure safety and efficiency in western North Dakota? These were estimates as of last September. We're looking to update these again this fall. It's a pretty in-depth process, but as of late last year, we were looking at about 64% of the oil still being trucked from the lease to one of the pipeline facilities or to one of the rail facilities. And so as this field matures, we expect this to shift. It almost has to, certainly, because we expect production to continue to rise. And unless we're going to keep adding more and more trucks to the fleet, even just to keep the same fleet of trucks busy, we're going to have to continue to develop the pipeline infrastructure going forward as production continues to rise. And the current market condition. So this is just a snapshot of the major refineries around the U.S. You can see the black barrels depicting the location and size of the refining centers. Again, just for scale, you can take a look at the Tesoro refinery there in Mandan. So the major refining centers in the Gulf Coast, East and West Coast. And this is a snapshot of what those refineries were paying for crude oil as of July. And so you can very quickly see that the East Coast and the West Coast had the highest price market conditions, around $107 a barrel, whereas the Mid-Continent, the Great Lakes, where we're traditionally marketing our crude oil, was around $101. And the way that the current national pipeline infrastructure is set up is that our crude oil can only make it to that pad 2 Mid-Continent refining. We have no pipeline access to the East Coast, no pipeline access to the West Coast, and very limited to no access to the Gulf Coast. And so the only way we're actually able to get to those higher price markets, again, is by rail car. And so you can see the major rail infrastructure in the U.S., and that is what ties North Dakota then to those premium priced markets. Typically, with this committee and others, we'd like to discuss wellhead pricing. And so this is just a snapshot. Again, the tax department, they use that 10% discount is kind of a typical fair average price for North Dakota barrel. And so you can see that in the last year or so, we've actually been getting a premium for the crude oil as we've been able to get oil to some of these higher priced markets, which is encouraging. The green line on this chart is actually showing the actual differential to WTI. And so we're still receiving on average less per barrel than WTI. In June, it was around $9 a barrel. But when we look at that 10%, it's kind of the rule of thumb that we are still above that 10% mark. So we'll switch gears now to natural gas. This is what has been keeping the Pipeline Authority very active here in the last couple months. Again, just reassessing all the natural gas information for the state. I'm going to start out globally, work my way down into North Dakota because I think it's worth taking a global approach and look to this. So we know that the U.S. is the world's number one natural gas producer. And when we look at world gas flaring estimates in 2011, the most recent data available, the U.S. made up 5.1% of all global gas flaring. When we take a look at the U.S. as a whole, over the last 60, 70 years or so, the U.S. has significantly reduced the amount of natural gas it's been flaring. So U.S. flaring, shown in brown on this chart. Again, during the boom of the petroleum industry in the U.S., new discoveries were found. Flaring, obviously, was at very high levels historically. And over time, market conditions, the economy that is more and more every day shifting more towards natural gas allowed market forces to bring U.S. flaring down to relatively low levels. And you can see 0.1 or 0.7% of all U.S. gas is flared. When we take a look at North Dakota's share of that, again, this is the most current EIA data available. North Dakota is making up around 24% of all U.S. flaring. And when we take out North Dakota completely from the equation, when we look at other states, in the last 10 years or so, almost doubling nationwide of natural gas flaring. And so why is this? Why is North Dakota rising? Why is the U.S. as a whole rising in gas flaring? And it's simply due to the new exploration and production of shale resources around the U.S. And so again, as we saw historically, new discoveries are found, infrastructure and markets begin to work, and flaring gets reduced. We expect the same thing to happen here in North Dakota, that again, the new discovery like the Bakken, the infrastructure and the markets are working around the clock in order to, again, reduce that flaring and get that valuable resource moved to market. So now down to the North Dakota level, our primary challenges. This committee is probably very well familiar with where our primary flaring challenges are. Obviously, the size of the resource, the young age of the development, still just a handful of years into this, and you know, winter working conditions, everything else that goes along with it. So some of the more detailed challenges, I won't go ahead and read all of these, but I'll touch on them here in my next set of slides. Obviously, understanding the resource is critical. Things we thought we knew 2 years ago are outdated and need to change, as well as our existing gas infrastructure needing to be updated. If we talk to the utility companies, whether it's pipeline or electrical, this is typically one of the top items that they're dealing with, is strengthening those landowner relations in western North Dakota. This we could discuss in great detail. It's going to take a lot of cooperation and coordination going forward. As you saw, the amount of pipelines getting put in the ground, and amount of electrical utility work, it's very fatiguing on the landowners in western North Dakota. And so strengthening this and working together is going to be paramount in order to keep this type of pace moving forward. Again, I won't touch on this in great detail. You know the value of the Bakken gas, not only the methane, but the natural gas liquids, which really prop up the value. So there is definite economic incentive for the industry to capture this gas as quickly as possible. Where we see natural gas production going in the future, again, following that similar upward trend as our crude oil, we expect a little bit more robust future for natural gas, again, just because of the way that the wells perform as they age. So about 2 to 2.5 billion cubic feet of gas per day expected, and now a little bit later peak, potentially in the late 2020s, as opposed to the oil peak in the early 2020s. Again, as we see the world today and as, you know, the assumptions I put into this model. This is a slide that is probably going to be new to this committee. I just put this together here in the last couple days where we're taking a look at, okay, which wells are flaring and what is their impact on North Dakota's overall percentage. So in July, we were flaring 29% of the gas, and I looked at every well and categorized them. So each of those columns, the tiers, are, you can see on the far left, a very small 0 to 1 MCF of flaring per day. The far right, 1,000 to 2,600 MCF of flaring per day, and the number of wells in each category. And then the bottom, or in red, is their impact on the state's 29% flaring. So you can see on the far left, we have, you know, in the first two columns, over 2,000 wells that if they were connected and went down to zero flaring, it would still be less than 1% of an impact on North Dakota's 29%. However, those 19 wells on the far right-hand side have almost 3% of an impact on the state's flaring. And so getting out and capturing the right wells at the right time is going to be paramount. So there's kind of a balancing act here. Obviously, from a volume reduction, you want to catch those 19 wells right away. From a social license to continue to operate, someone driving down the road they don't really care if it's, you know, ripping at 2,600 MCF a day, or if it's just a lazy flare at, you know, 10 MCF a day. A flare is a flare, and we want to get those reduced as well. And so the economics very much so get the industry pushed to connect those 19 wells first, but it's going to be more of a challenge to get folks to capture some of those more remote or low volume wells, maybe until hopefully a second infill well is drilled or there's some other incentive in place to go after those 2,000 wells. And so again, now breaking down the flaring challenge, I said 29% of the gas was flared in July. I look at every single well and throw them into two buckets. The 15% are in red. Those are wells that are actually connected to gas gathering systems. They have a pipeline connected to them. And the 14% are wells that are waiting for a pipeline to be built. And so we've actually shifted now to more of our gas flaring taking place from wells that do have pipelines connected to them. It's just that the pipeline's not adequate to handle the volume that's moving through these systems. And so I'll now just take a breakdown of each of these two categories and what can be done to address that. Obviously, the 14% that don't have pipelines, you just need more pipeline in the ground. And so what's happening on that front, I track every month the number of wells that begin producing and the number of wells that the gas industry is connecting. And historically, looking back, the red line on this chart, new wells producing, has outpaced the black line of new wells connected until the last year or so. The industry has essentially caught up, and now here over the summer made some significant progress in not only meeting the pace of production, but exceeding it and starting to work on the backlog of wells that have built up. And it's not only important, as we saw in that histogram chart earlier, to just go connect wells. I mean, you got to connect where the flush production is. And so this is just a snapshot of the number of wells that were connected in 2013. All the black wells are connected. And so this chart, it's a little bit busy, but if you look at 2013, where the bulk of new wells connected. And so the industry wasn't going out and connecting wells from 2008 or 2009. The industry was focused on connecting wells that were drilled in 2013 and wells that were drilled in 2012, because again, that's where the flush production is, and that's what's driving the economics right now. And the good news on this front, again, this is that chart that I've always had out, the number of wells in black that are connected to gas sales, and then the number of wells that are still waiting to be connected in red. And so we're hoping, I don't want to say that we have hit our peak on that red line, but if industry continues to outpace the drilling activity, we will see this red line level off and start its downward trend going forward, which is very positive news. That 15%, the wells that are flaring because of challenges on their existing pipeline system. And so here's just one scenario of why that would happen. You know, on the top graphic here, you've got three older wells. They're all connected to a pipeline, no flaring. They're selling all their gas. Everything is great. You bring on one brand new Bakken Three Forks well and you connect it to that pipeline system. Those new wells come on at such high pressure that they basically kick off all the old wells upstream of it, and they'll force their gas to the gas plant. And so the industry will have to come in and they'll have to enhance that pipeline to add compressor systems to allow those lower pressure wells to flow to the gas plant. another scenario up at the top where a pipeline may have been installed, you know, as early as just a few years ago, but the industry wasn't expecting to have, you know, 4 to 6 to 8 wells per pad, and the system just was undersized, and so the companies are going back and having to add a second pipeline alongside an existing one. I've heard cases where they're adding a third pipeline along because, again, they still didn't get it right on the second time. So lots of challenges correctly sizing this infrastructure because, again, we're learning so much about how these wells perform and what type of drilling scenarios we're going to have going forward. And then lastly, one of the challenges is making sure that those natural gas liquids don't settle out in our pipeline systems. Again, that Bakken gas is very rich, and so those liquids tend to pool at the bottom of the pipeline, and every inch of that pipe is crucial and valuable, and so they'll have to pig these lines or put a squeegee essentially through there very frequently to keep all those liquids cleaned out so that they can maximize every inch of that system. We've got a handful of newer expanding gas plants coming on. This is actually a little incorrect. It's now, I think, 5 or 6 newer expanding plants coming on here in the next several years. Again, our challenge today is primarily at that local gathering level, but once you get past the gathering challenge, you have to have the processing in place to handle that gas. And we see that being constructed or planned as we speak. And so we expect gas processing to continue to build out at a pace that's adequate for our production levels. And then after the gas plant, the key then is finding an interstate or large diameter, high flow pipeline system to move that gas to market. And so you've seen this slide last summer when we had that pipeline authority study done by Bentec. This was one snapshot showing that long term for North Dakota, this could be a challenge, and economically, industry should start looking at some other options for moving our gas, and they definitely are. Over the summer, you've probably read in the newspaper about WBI transmission proposing a pipeline, a natural gas line from western North Dakota east towards Minnesota. That's one market solution that's being developed. And there may be others coming that take a look at, again, how can we add value to this gas by moving it to non-traditional markets. Flaring alternatives, again, whether that's burning the natural gas at the well site for electricity, converting it to natural gas fertilizer, or what have you. If any of you have any interest, please visit my website. We've got videos, webinars by the companies themselves discussing what their technologies are and their timelines going forward. And then this is just an update of the North Dakota's oil industry kind of efficiency estimates. And so the top pie chart there, we take a look at all the wells in western North Dakota, and we consider the gas that's being flared. From a pure economic standpoint, 97% of the dollar value coming up out of each of those wells is still being captured. And when we take a look at it from a pure just an energy standpoint of how much energy is being wasted, by North Dakota's petroleum industry, it's around 7% of the energy lost due to flaring, and 93% of the energy coming up from the Bakken Three Forks and other wells in North Dakota. 93% of that energy is still captured and moved to market. So we can see very clearly here that obviously this is an oil play, and oil continues to drive the economics to keep people to drill. And from an energy standpoint, you know, there's still 7% of a big number is still a lot, and there's still a lot of value in that 3% and in that 7%. So we're not seeing the industry give up anytime soon. They're going to continue to go aggressively after not only the dollar value, but the energy value in that natural gas resource. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions the committee will have.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Severingle.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kringstad, I think the oil loading rail facilities have jumped from about 11 to 22 in a pretty short order. Are we reaching the level needed, or do you see additional units coming on in the next year or two? And how many unit trains leave each site on average?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are 22 facilities today. Like I said, there's a handful of others in the works. How many is kind of that ceiling of what's necessary? I think the market will decide that. I think we may see the larger facilities continue to get larger. We'll see, all of the new facilities will be unit train facilities. I don't know that we'll see many new manifest or smaller loading facilities. And so the economies of scale, like I said, they're just driving the industry towards those bigger facilities. We do not have records of what each facility is doing. I just have that statewide number. But on average, 650,000 barrels a day is about 10 unit trains a day loaded, leaving another 10 unloaded coming back in. So,
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Justin, a couple of questions for you. I attended our Enbridge pipeline meeting, public information meeting in the Grand Forks area a month or so ago. And they were moving along pretty well and fairly optimistic, but I think I read in the paper that Minnesota kind of squashed them. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, I have not had a chance to speak with them on the Minnesota regulatory side of what challenges they have there. Okay.
All right. I think that their potential there was around 800,000 barrels. Is that possible? Was it that big?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, Enbridge, their Sam Piper pipeline is the open house that you attended, and that is North Dakota's single largest project on the crude oil side that we're working with. I believe it's around 325,000 barrels a day.
Thank you.
Yep.
And then, if I may continue, Mr. Chairman, just the simple question, we're talking about corrosion on the Tioga spill here that's in the news. In a pipeline of that age, is that corrosion most likely to be from the inside out or the outside in?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, I do not have any details. The Pipeline Authority being a non-regulatory agency, I'm not privy to any of that information as far as the investigations go.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions? Oh, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question and a request. With going back to the refinery infrastructure page, can you tell us why Pad 4 is so much cheaper than everybody else? I was just kind of curious as to, I know that's far beyond your control, but.
Yep. And so, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, and so it's completely market-driven with supply and demand, and so very little refining infrastructure in that Pad 4, and so the supply that they must have is adequate or high enough that they can justify that supply-demand, what they offer to pay for crude oil. So.
Okay. And then just a quick
look.
Thank you. Just a quick request. I'm assuming you have this in PDF or PowerPoint format. Could this get sent to the committee so we have an electronic form? Would be good to have, or is it going to be on the website?
Yep. We can definitely get that to you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your information. We're going to take a 10-minute break, and we'll be back, and we'll hear our last two presentations. Let's bring the committee back to order. Get it rolling. Okay, at this time we'll take the 245 agenda item, and we have Mr. Lynn Helms from the Department of Mineral Resources.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Energy Development Transmission Committee. I handed out a paper copy of my testimony, and I've loaded it on Tim's computer here. Well, is this your computer? But I can also email it or send it however works for you. As I understand it, my task is to talk some about the global perspective of oil and gas and then try to bring that back to North Dakota and how that may affect oil and gas prices and production over the next, I chose 30 years because I was able to get the information over a 30-year window. So that's what I chose. So we'll kind of dive off into that, if you don't mind. I've loaded the wrong presentation here, so I really apologize for that. This is not the one. This is from July. If you'll bear with me just a minute, I'll load the right one. You have it in paper copy, but it's nicer to look at it on the screen, and the folks in the seats can see it better. So, Is that the right one? Here it is. I have no idea why that one came up, but there we go. Thank you for your patience. Let's start with crude oil in 2010 and talk about the current picture of the global crude oil production and consumption. This lays out really all of the big producers and consumers, and I don't want to spend a great deal of time dwelling on it. I just want to point out the black bars, the large consumers. The United States, obviously the largest, consuming 26% of the world's crude oil production, which currently is about 90 million barrels a day. The European Union coming in right behind that, so that would be all of the countries on the Western European continent coming in at 19%, and then China at 6% and growing very rapidly. When you look at the production side or the supply side, you see, again, Saudi Arabia number one, United States number two, Russia number three, and you've all heard the estimates that between now and 2020, in fact, EIA is now saying maybe next year, the United States will surpass Saudi Arabia to become the number one crude oil producer in the world. So crude oil is, of course, a very fungible product. It's priced globally. It can move pretty easily around the globe because of the technology of these VLCCs, or these crude ships that can carry 20 million barrels of oil and move it quite rapidly. There is a limit to that fungibility, though, and I have a slide kind of talking about that, and that would be the 1979 U.S. law that says we cannot export crude oil. So there is a law in place, and it is under the directive of the President of the United States, and the limits on that, of course, if it's a NAFTA country, we can to some extent to Mexico or Canada. But even there, it has to be an exchange process. That law was negotiated in order to get the Trans-Alaska pipeline approved. And Congress wanted to make sure that that oil didn't leave the country. So that's how, and it's still there since 1979. We'll talk about, I have a graph on that. If you look at the next page down, you can see then what the changes are that are projected over the next 30 years. And since they lumped it as OECD and non-OECD, I thought, well, I better define OECD for everybody. So there they are, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries. And there are some that are notably absent from that list. For example, Russia, Brazil, Iran, Iraq, some of those. So it's important that we recognize that. Let's just talk about some of the significant bars there. If you look at, this is growth in millions of barrels per day. OECD Americas, well, let's start with Europe. Basically, nothing happening in Europe. No growth in consumption, no growth in production. So even with the discoveries that are going on between Denmark and Norway, that's going to be pretty much a whole even situation. So the market doesn't grow, the supply doesn't grow in Europe, even though they consume 19% of the world's crude oil. So you might guess they are going to be a big target for the folks that are expanding their black bars. OECD Americas, that's the U.S. and Canada. All right. So what you're looking at there, of course, is some substantial growth in consumption, the orange bar, but pretty enormous growth in production. And the net result of that, as we look at the map on the next couple pages, is going to be that North America becomes self-sufficient in the crude oil market. Africa, kind of a similar story. Non-OECD Europe and Asia, that's the Caspian Sea countries, and Russia is who that is. And as you can see, some significant growth, more growth than we have in consumption, but an equal amount of growth in production. Non-OECD Americas, that's Brazil. And there again, same amount of growth in consumption, but enormous growth in production. The Middle East, Look at the increased consumption there. That's because they burn a lot of liquid petroleum to generate electricity. I don't know what their out from that is going to be to start burning natural gas, and that's only going to temper this. Why is the black bar so large? It's anticipated that Iraq will be able to rebuild its production from roughly 1.5 million barrels a day today to what it was pre-Gulf War, or what its potential was, which is 5 or 6 million barrels a day, and then that the Iranian sanctions will come off sometime in the next 30 years, and Iran will come on really strong with a little bit of growth in Saudi Arabia. The standout here is non-OECD Asia. That is China and India. And that's where all of this crude oil wants to go over the next 30 years. So if we flip the page and we look at the maps, I didn't put them both on this graph, but this is what it looks like today. So you can see a lot of crude oil movement around the globe, a fair amount of imports going into Europe, a fair amount coming into the United States, some from Brazil, some from Colombia and Venezuela, Mexico, Canada is our largest supplier. Africa sends some over to the Northeast. That's what the train loads of Bakken crude oil are designed to displace, is that 10% coming from Africa and 2% from the North Sea. And you see a lot of arrows headed for China and Japan and for Asia and those countries. If you jump 30 years in the future, this picture really changes. If you look at page 5, basically, like I said, North America becomes completely self-sufficient in terms of liquid petroleum. That forces all of that South American oil, forces Venezuela all the way to China, forces Brazil to China and India. It forces the African countries to move from Europe largely into Asia. And Russia joins the picture trying to get oil out of Siberia into China. That's going to put a lot of pressure on markets. For all those arrows to be pointed to the same place is going to put a lot of pressure on markets. And so when we look at North Dakota crude oil prices, right now they're in a great place, as you saw on Justin's slide. But we're going to, as these arrows begin to shift from the United States to China and Europe and other places, we're going to see soft spots in that market and that price for light sweet crude oil. And many of our refineries are going to need to retool back from heavy Canadian sour to light sweet. And that won't happen overnight. So EIA, and I would agree with it, is anticipating some significant softness in crude oil prices in North Dakota next year. And probably, you know, every so often after that. So we need to keep that in mind as we build budgets and think about production and rigs and tax policy and all of those things, that this is an enormous shift that nobody anticipated, and it's 100% the result of shale oil, unconventional resources. This also really discounts the impact of some potential plays like the Monterey Shale in California. If the Monterey is as good as the USGS has evaluated it, there'll be an even greater shift. And we will see essentially all of the need for oil from Mexico and Canada perhaps wiped out by the Monterey Shale in Central California. So, you know, the picture, the overall picture doesn't change a whole lot, but if you start to force Canadian crude oil across the ocean, or Mexican crude oil across the ocean, then you really can start to soften the U.S. market, and you disconnect us from the market. And so being disconnected like that, we create our own market, and to reconnect takes time and money. And so we'll see how all that goes. That's the crude oil picture. I want to end, and we'll take questions on crude oil with page 6. Page 6 here is the history of oil exports from the United States. You can see that there's one enormous spike there in the 1950s, and then you can see the Alaska Pipeline coming on in 1979, and that's when the Export Administration Act of 1979, and it's been amended many times. It's a nice little document that looks like this. So it's, if you're ever in need of some light reading, that's the Export Administration Act and the subsequent regulations, but I've marked the sections that pertain to crude oil, domestically produced crude oil. I think the significant thing there is that, with a few exceptions, export of crude oil from the United States is prohibited. And it would take congressional action to change that. There are some exceptions. It can be exported for use by the U.S. military, and I didn't get it on this slide, but it also can be exported to a limited extent to NAFTA countries. So, for example, we have, in any given day, 10,000 to 50,000 barrels going to St. John's, New Brunswick, by rail car. A very skinny little margin out of our 900,000 barrels a day, but there are some limited, but that has to be approved by the President of the United States and on an exchange program. There is about 11,000 barrels a day that travels through Portal, North Dakota and up into Saskatchewan, but that's just so it can get on a pipe and come right back in through Minnesota to our U.S. refineries. So the only U.S. crude that is leaving the country and being refined outside the United States is, on any given day, somewhere between 10,000 and 50,000 barrels a day that's going to St. John's, New Brunswick, which that refinery feeds a lot of refined products back into the northeastern U.S. With that, I'll stop and we can talk about crude oil, if you'd like.
See, anyone have any questions for Lynn? Senator Andrist.
Mr. Chairman, Lynn, I thought I read the other day that this past year now, or these past months, I don't know which the time frame was, for the first time we've become a net energy exporter. Is that not true? Factual information?
Mr. Chairman.
A net crude oil exporter, I thought it was.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Andrus, it's actually refined products, and this allows for large volumes of refined products to be exported. So our Gulf Coast refinery.
Not true of crude though.
No, not true of crude oil or electricity or even natural gas yet at this point, but it is true of refined products. So when you take all in. And you look at the volume of diesel fuel and gasoline and whatnot that are leaving the country and dominantly going to Mexico, then we are a net exporter of energy. And so we're actually, you know, doing the vast, vast majority of that refining here in the United States and shipping the refined products out is where they're going. So.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions?
Let's jump to natural gas. An equally interesting picture. If you look at page 8, you can see what is taking place natural gas-wise. The United States in 2010, the green bars up there in the upper left, show a lot of import of natural gas. 10 years from now, we're roughly in balance or a slight exporter, and by 30 years from now, we need to be exporting a lot of natural gas, twice as much as we're importing right now under the current price scenarios. Canada, right next to us, is always an exporter and remains a large exporter, and it looks like they want to shift to liquefied natural gas and move that across the water to Europe and to Asia. The market for pipeline natural gas, you can see it on the map there, where the market is. And so we're competing for that market with Canadian, Rocky Mountain, Mid-Continent, Southeast, Texas, Gulf of Mexico, and now Northeast gas as the Marcellus continues to increase production and that wave of natural gas from the Northeast sweeps back towards Chicago and Michigan and takes out our traditional markets. And when you look at the cost, the variable transport cost, we're at a disadvantage. We're second in terms of getting it up there from the Gulf of Mexico, but we'll be very disadvantaged on the gas coming from the Northeast. And so we're going to get squeezed pretty hard on natural gas prices. And natural gas prices don't look like there is a significant recovery for a very long time in terms of natural gas. So that's the impact. Oil prices kind of up and down with some soft spots. Natural gas prices pretty stable and low. So as we're thinking about all these things that we'd like to see these industries come in and use natural gas, there should be a large, relatively low-priced, stable gas stream for them to make into urea and fertilizer and plastic and all of the things. So so we have that potential, and we're probably going to be looking at it for electric generation. Based on recent happenings with our coal industry and federal regulations, that will take a while to work itself out. But we need to triple or quadruple our power production and transmission over the same time period. And this is a pretty obvious place where that's likely to come from, is lots of gas-fired power plants. However, the rules are pretty strict on those gas-fired power plants, too. There will probably have to be some new technology or some carbon capture on those gas pipelines. If you jump to page 9, this is those same charts for the rest of the world. And I want to point out a few things. First of all, along the top line in the center chart, you can see that Europe is a big importer and will continue to be a big importer. Russia likes to be their major supplier. You can see them as the huge exporter there in Central Asia. This is why Vladimir Putin promotes movies against fracking and that sort of thing, because he's trying to protect his market. He does not want Poland and France producing natural gas using the same technologies that we use here. So he's a big backer of anti-hydraulic fracturing movements, and it's just the way it is. If you move on across and you see OECD Asia, that's again Japan and South Korea and those countries, huge importers of natural gas. Australia is primed to be the supplier of that, as well as Qatar and some of the Middle Eastern countries. The Arabian oil producers are going to become net importers of natural gas because they have to switch from using crude oil to generate electricity and distill water to use of natural gas. And so there's going to be a big shift take place over there. You can see that Qatar and Iran are the big gas producers. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, they're going to have to become natural gas importers. Africa stays an exporter, and non-OECD Asia, huge imports into China and India and those other countries. So when you look at that on a map, this is what it looks like today. There's gas moving all over the place, mostly by pipeline, but the liquefied natural gas industry is starting to get its legs under it. If you ever have the chance to visit an LNG facility, I strongly encourage it. This is technology that was developed primarily in Alaska on the Kenai Peninsula there. One of the first liquefied natural gas plants was built there to take Gulf of Alaska gas, liquefy it, and ship it to Japan. And all kinds of industries grew up around that. But basically, they learned how to use 5% of the natural gas to liquefy 95%. So it's a very efficient process using compression and expansion and chill boxes and all that sort of thing. So there's only about a 5% loss when you liquefy natural gas and put it in these enormous boats and send it across the ocean. What grew up around Japan, where a large amount of this liquefied natural gas leaves the boat and goes in, is all sorts of uses for the cold. They flash freeze fish and do all kinds of things like that. So all sorts of strange industries grow up around these LNG ports to use the heat and the cold that's generated. If you jump to the future, this becomes a really, really competitive situation.
Norway had planned on liquefying its natural gas and sending it over here. That all has to ship to Europe. The Marcellus producers want to liquefy their gas now and send it to Europe. South America wants to liquefy their natural gas and send it to Europe. Alaska to Japan, Canada to China. And so you can see there are two sinks and lots of sources. And so we're looking at a long-term, fairly low price situation for North American natural gas. All of the LNG wants to find itself either in Western Europe or China. And everybody's going to be competing for that market. So, again, what does that mean to North Dakota? It means long-term, you saw Justin's price curve, it means that natural gas is going to be priced, especially since it's associated with very economic oil production, fairly low and pretty stable for a long period of time, which is going to be good for our gas-consuming industries, which we're going to need. That's natural gas. Is that okay?
Representative Silverdale.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Speaker, with the growth in natural gas, is transportation gaining any traction as using natural gas as a fuel for a transportation fleet, or is that still going nowhere?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Silvernagle, there's a lot of progress taking place in that area, both compressed natural gas, CNG, but even more so the liquefied natural gas. I know that the railroads are looking at conversion, substantial conversion to LNG, because it's cheaper than diesel, and the oil industry has begun to build drilling rigs and frack fleets that run on CNG. So that is an industry that we ought to pursue in North Dakota, policy-wise, tax-wise, however-wise, as hard as we possibly can. It will be a big help in reducing flaring and value-added use of our natural gas, and it's areas that are already, the technology is really there, or very, very close to go to CNG and LNG for fleets of vehicles and trains and big heavy equipment. So,
Senator Andrews.
Mr. Chairman, what's the primary market for liquefied natural gas? Is it large commercial? I don't see it happening in the residential areas. Probably 25 years ago, they were building some municipal, few small municipal systems, and they sort of quickly died in the vine.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Andrews, you're absolutely correct. It's industrial, almost all industrial. And that's why the Alaska to Japan connection occurred in the late 70s, early 80s, was, of course, Japan's economy was booming at that time, their industrial economy, not so much since. And Alaska had all this natural gas and no place to go with it. By the way, if at some point the North Slope natural gas has to find a place to go, and it makes other natural gas reserves, you know, look like the seven dwarfs, so to speak, in terms of the amount of gas that is up there, just in Prudhoe Bay and on the North Slope. But it is industrial use. That's where liquefied natural gas likes to go. The new technology that's, you know, right on that edge that could use a little bump in terms of tax incentives and that would be for transportation fuel, because it is so clean. And you see a lot of city buses now that are running CNG and LNG, and we're going to see more and more and more of that because it is such a clean burning fuel. But up to this point, it's been industrial. And that's why so many arrows point to China, and why so many arrows point to Europe. Europe has sworn off nuclear power and coal, and so there's only one place to get electricity. Well, there's two places: wind supplemented with natural gas. That's all they've got if they don't use coal and nuclear. So industrial and electric generation.
Okay, anyone else?
Let's look a little bit at what's going on in North Dakota then. This is new well permits issued, and so I just want to point out that, you know, a year ago, we could not have told you where the top of this chart was, and of course it will be subject to oil price and federal regulation and that sort of thing, but we've kind of found our place. We found our plateau at about 2,500 permits a year, which will result in excess of 2,000 wells a year. I just redid this chart based on the most recent couple months data, and it's going to look like it's above 2,500, but that's temporary. We always build seasonality into this, so I hire a bunch of temps and I shift a bunch of people into permitting for August, September, and October, so that people can permit wells and build locations before the winter weather sets in, because the last thing you want them trying to do is move you know, heavy earth-moving equipment in McKenzie County today, you know, or try to build a location after freeze-up. So we make that shift, and always there's going to be that three-month period in there that kind of skews the rest of the data. But basically, we found our plateau. That's pretty much where we expect to stay for about 20 years. That's what it'll take. It'll take that level of permitting for 20 years to develop phase three of the Bakken. So that's a long time. We won't probably all be meeting here in 20 years. This is our rig count, and it has followed the same sort of a pattern. 218 was the peak in 2012. As the rush was on to finish phase two of the drilling, it pretty quickly dropped over about 3 months down to that 185 number, and that's where we expect to stay, right in that range for 20 years. It will take that many rigs working for 20 years to complete phase three of the Bakken and Three Forks development. If we look at page 14, this is our oil production estimates. Black line where we are, the green line the revenue forecast, the blue line is everything going right, and so, you know, we continue to just march upward pretty rapidly in terms of oil production, but there are always storm clouds on the horizon, and they should always be incorporated and planned into our production and revenue forecasts. This is the development area of the Bakken. I just want to point out that there are a couple of spots there on the divide Williams County border that you can see, and out there in the federal lands, that are still in phase two, where the leases have not been completely de-risked. There are some geology problems in those areas as well, but most of the Bakken has finished the de-risking or phase two phase. Sanish, the really yellow area there, is what the map will look like 20 years from now. That's into phase three drilling and early in phase three. Talk about that right at the end. The Tyler, this is the area that is underlain by mature Tyler source rock, and so you can see the areas that could be impacted as the Tyler develops. We have one well drilling in the Tyler right now, and if we jump back and we look at that area, it's just south of that little southern black oval there on the Slope Billings Stark County border. It's just south of there is where this map is. So that little black spot is Rocky Ridge Field, and that well is drilling right now. There are four additional wells scheduled to follow it back to back to back. So where's the Tyler at? It's about where the Bakken was in 03-04. First well going in the ground. Remember, it took 2 years before we got a really exciting Bakken well that caused the thing to take off, and then it really took three more years before it skyrocketed. So 2 to 5 years before it gets really exciting down there, but we're encouraged to see a company of this stature recognize the value, the potential value of the Tyler formation. These folks really study things before they make this kind of investment. So it's a company of really high stature that's looking at it. The Spearfish is into phase two. You can see the phase two wells there as they're de-risking the leases, and that's up by Botno. This is what phase three for that play is projected to look like. So they're looking at shifting into phase three sometime in this seven-year time window, maybe halfway through. And so that phase of drilling brings 24 wells per square mile in the Spearfish play. And so that's what those drilled up blocks up there look like. The empty blocks are, you know, put one well in there, de-risk the leases, and then the next phase would be to drill them, infill them with 23 additional wells in each square mile. Mission Canyon is really pretty much asleep right now. And this is, you know, the traditional Northeast Mission Canyon play in Western Botno, Renville, and Burt counties. It's really asleep right now. It's just crowded out by the economics. This is what a Mission Canyon horizontal well can and should look like. There are two of them being drilled right now. And so again, it's some years off from really making its mark in terms of the oil markets. But I wanted you to know that there are things coming in to backfill the Bakken as the Bakken ramps up and then begins to wane. So where are we at? For this, we looked out about 20 years, the last page. 185 rigs can put about 2,000 wells a year in the ground based on 2,500 permits. The 218 rigs finished that first phase of drilling, and phase one was defining the geographical area of the play. And that really ended in 2012. There's still a couple of areas, as I pointed out, that are in phase two, but if they stay at it, they ought to be able to finish that in about 12 months. And then there's the phase three drilling, which is that increased density drilling, and that'll take 20 years at 185 rigs. There's another phase that people are starting to talk about, and that's enhanced oil recovery. None of this includes one penny of enhanced oil recovery. So this is 10 billion barrels of oil, 20 years of drilling, 45,000 wells, all just for primary recovery, which is 10 billion barrels out of a resource of about 300 to 500 billion. So everybody is focusing now on enhanced oil recovery. How could we get 1% more, which is 3 to 5 billion barrels? And so you'll see a great deal of focus at EERC, at UND, amongst the big companies, Marathon, EOG, Whiting, all of them signing on to start looking at enhanced oil recovery. And is there a way to squeeze a little bit more out of this rock? Because with this, we're leaving 95 or more barrels out of every 100 behind. We're not recovering a high percentage. With that, Mr. Chairman, I take questions, but that's kind of how the world picture shrinks down to North Dakota and what we see happening here, you know, a 30-year picture for the world down to a 20-year picture for North Dakota.
Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Helms, that was my question, is that we are hanging around 5 to 6% recovery right now, and you answered that after I pushed the button, so thank you.
And do you have any idea what some of the techniques might be, or would be CO2, or are there still research and development going on as far as enhanced oil recovery?
Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of research going on. Right now, CO2 is the leader in the race. There have been some lab tests done that show that CO2 mobilizes Bakken oil like nothing you've ever seen before. The challenge will be, can we get a bubble of CO2 to contact a fracture and touch that Bakken oil? If it does, it wants to replace it and push it out. So it's the leader right now. Nitrogen was kind of in the lead a year ago, but the lab tests show that, amazingly, in fact, the lab made this comment. They've never seen an oil less compatible with nitrogen than Bakken crude oil. So, it's been used for for enhanced oil recovery. Some places around the world, we used it in Alaska, but they said it's absolutely the worst thing you could do to your reservoir based on the lab tests in the Bakken. So the shift has been to CO2. I know there are folks looking at other things. Water they're looking at. We have a couple of pilots going on in partial field trying water. But as you know, water and oil don't mix. And so that's a pressure type of thing that you're trying to do. So right now CO2 is the leader. And obviously, if we're going to use coal at all to generate that 3 to 4-fold power need that we have, then CO2 is going to be the make or break on that. Is can we come up with a technology to capture it and utilize it and sequester it? And right now, I don't think that technology isn't tested. But
are we looking at the unitization, and do we have to worry about reservoir pressure and all that with the Bakken, just like we did with those other formations?
Mr. Chairman, we absolutely do need to worry about that. And not surprisingly, I have a unit proposal that has been filed, and we're going to hold the hearing next month. It's a 25,000-acre unit in the Bakken, and then one that is kind of in preliminary discussion phases and the documents haven't been filed, that will be about 1.5 times that, so in the neighborhood of 40,000. So they're starting to come, and quite rapidly. You know, we did one a couple of years ago, but now I've got one in the pipeline and one coming right behind it. So yes, oil companies are, they are really, really serious about this.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions, comments?
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you for that update. Okay, let's move on to our next presentation, 315. Okay, Patrice. Shift to wind energy.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Patrice Lalum, and I am a program consultant to the Great Plains Institute. Thank you for having me here today to talk about wind energy. I believe that someone on your committee asked for this presentation during your last meeting. Just a little bit about the Great Plains Institute. We're a nonprofit that's based in North Dakota and Minnesota. I live and work in North Dakota, and a previous life was at the State Agriculture Department for just over a decade. We work on a variety of technologies and issues, including advanced fossil energy technology, energy efficiency, and renewable energy development. And just to the point of Mr. Helms' closing comments about enhanced oil recovery, the Great Plains Institute co-convenes the National Enhanced Oil Recovery Initiative, and so it's an issue that we care a lot about and are looking very closely at. We do a lot of convening of stakeholders around issues that sometimes have diversity, and so we have kind of a four-pronged policy approach. We tend to convene sort of unusual bedfellows and form, and then work to agree on issues and then act upon them. And we work on a lot of issues: energy efficiency, I mentioned fossil fuels, transportation, sustainable communities, a wide portfolio of interests and issues in the Great Plains Institute's work. I noted on your agenda the global perspective that you were looking at with oil and gas, and I thought I'd start off with a global perspective on clean energy just to sort of set the stage. And taking a look, this is looking at private investment, not government investment, but private investment in clean energy globally. And in the year 2012, and this is from Bloomberg Finance, who put together this report and study, China leads the way around the world in clean energy investments, nearly double what the U.S. invested in clean energy technologies in 2012. But we've seen sort of steady growth globally over the last several years. This chart takes three-year increments and looks at the investment globally. And so we are seeing a steady increase of private sector money going into clean energy around the world. One thing, though, that is clear in looking at the leaderboard as far as China and where they stand in other countries, the countries that are rising to the top year after year tend to be countries that have specific clean energy targets and goals. And at this point, the U.S. doesn't really have a comprehensive set of policies regarding clean energy. And as Lynn and others noted earlier today and was in the news this past week, you know, EIA is reporting and predicting that the U.S. will be the top oil and gas producer in the world in 2013. And earlier this year, another study was issued talking about energy independence for the U.S. by 2035. And while oil and gas will certainly be the primary drivers of that energy independence, the study also noted that there's sort of a three-legged stool in play. And oil and gas production will be central to that. However, biofuel production and vehicle fuel efficiency are the other two things we need in combination to actually make us energy independent by 2035. Which puts North Dakota in a very unique position. We're obviously blessed with very abundant oil and gas resources. We have an 800-year supply of coal. They talk about us being the Saudi Arabia of wind. Agriculture for a long, long time has been our leading industry, and we have abundant feedstocks for biofuel production. And maybe there's more. So we certainly stand ready and able to help guide our country to energy independence. Just taking a quick look, quick snapshot at our energy rankings. Obviously, as Lynn touched on, second in crude oil production, ninth in coal, but we're also 10th nationally in ethanol production and 11th in installed wind capacity. And so from the renewable, on the renewable front, we're doing quite well as well. The North Dakota Alliance for Renewable Energy, along with a grant from the North Dakota Department of Commerce, conducted an energy renewable energy economic impact study in 2012. And the NDSU's Agribusiness and Applied Economics Department completed that study for us. And what that indicated is that renewable energy, in particular wind and ethanol, are major contributors to our state's economy to the tune of $1.2 billion in annual economic activity. Construction expenditures over a 10-year period were almost $3 billion, and over $10 billion in total economic impact over a 10-year period. So renewable energy is alive and well in North Dakota and is making a significant contribution both to our energy mix but also to our economy. Part to the success of a renewable energy is a slide showing what the state has done and state programs and policies that are helping the industry. There's a statewide renewable energy council that was put in place during the 2007 legislative session. During this past legislative session, you provided funding, $3 million of funding for the upcoming biennium from the Resources Trust Fund. Prior to that, the Renewable Energy Council had received funding from the General Fund and other sources. You also implemented an energy conservation grant program for public buildings for the first time, which is a fantastic step in the area of energy efficiency for public buildings around the state. There's a blender pump program that's available through the Department of Commerce that provides grants and cost sharing for the installation of blender pump equipment for ethanol. I believe your committee is taking a look at and heard from Commissioner Anderson about the value-added studies for renewable energy that was funded as part of the legislative session. The Fuel Production Facility Loan Guarantee Program, it's a guarantee program that was revised two sessions ago and increased, the amount of the guarantees was increased this session, which would be available for biofuel facilities. The counter-cyclical ethanol production incentive you have in place, and that's been around for a while, and then various tax incentives. An exemption for wind energy facilities that was extended this past legislative session through 2017, and some sales tax and property tax exemptions as well. And wind has been quite a story. We all know it's windy in North Dakota. If you step outside today, the wind is mixed with rain, which can be not so pleasant, but we've seen just a tremendous increase, a 334-fold increase in wind energy. To think in the early 2000s, there was, you know, not a single megawatt installed. It's pretty remarkable to look at that development and growth. Just over 1,670 megawatts of installed capacity right now, and I know Commissioner Kalk was on your schedule earlier today. The Bison, there's four parts of the Bison Wind Farm. The fourth is under construction right now. Thunder Spirit in Adams County just received approval from the Public Service Commission this week. We have almost 1,000 operating turbines across the state. The unique thing, or a good thing about wind energy, we've got commercial scale projects in 18 North Dakota counties, and I'll show you a map in just a minute that shows the landscape and how spread out and how they cover North Dakota. According to the Public Service Commission, there's 6,000 plus megawatts of potential projects that are in the queue at the PSC. I mentioned before that we have been called the Saudi Arabia of wind. North Dakota's wind potential, we're ranked as the sixth windiest state. According to AWEA, the National Wind Energy Association, capital investments of more than $3.3 billion have been made in North Dakota via wind energy. And that translates into annual lease payments of $5 million to landowners. And that's significant and important for landowners across the state. And approximately 1,000 jobs, both direct and indirect, for the wind industry. Wind manufacturing has also just recently been back in the news. LM Wind Power just announced this week that they'll be increasing their workforce again this year to meet demand, and will be employing more than 600 people in North Dakota by the end of the year. I'll talk a minute about the federal production tax credit and the impact that's had, and certainly that's led to some uncertainty in the manufacturing center and manufacturing sector, and kind of an ebb and flow in their workforce. We've seen actually one wind manufacturing facility go out of business or transition away from that type of manufacturing as a result of that market uncertainty. So here is the map that I was speaking of just a minute ago, and as you can see, the wind power and projects are again in 18 different counties, and show the Bison 4 project under construction right now, and also listed the Crown Butte project down in Adams County as soon to be under construction. This slide just depicts for you the cost of wind energy have come down, so the blue bars show the cents per kilowatt hour as far as the cost of wind power. And you'll see the green line, and that shows the amount of wind installed by gigawatt for the U.S. And so the costs are coming down, and the amount of wind power coming online is going up. And I think that wind installed nationally was the largest source of generation installed nationally last year. So a little bit about the federal policies surrounding wind. And so the largest and most talked about is the federal production tax credit. And the PTC is available to a variety of renewable sources, and sort of the terms of that tax credit varies by source. For wind, an owner of a wind project will receive a reduction of 2.3 cents for every kilowatt hour produced on their tax bill over a 10-year period. The credit's taken when energy is produced from the project, and it doesn't apply during the development and construction phases. So the PTC was extended for 1 year. It will apply to wind projects that begin or commence construction prior to January 1, 2014. So it's a one-year extension of that policy. But as you can see by this chart, it seems as though there are some correlations between the expiration and then extension of the PTC. The PTC has expired five times over the course of dating back to the late 90s, and it's been extended four times. And so it's been a series of fits and starts. Sometimes the extensions and expirations have been allowed to happen, and then there's a retroactive extension of the production tax credit. It's just, it has not been a very stable indicator to the market whatsoever for wind. And there are a lot of questions. Certainly, with the federal budget situation at hand, there is a lot of scrutiny over the types of incentives that are applied to a variety of industries. Just last week, a Joint Committee on Taxation, the House Joint Committee on Taxation, held a hearing looking at the production tax credit and showing that if they were to extend it just for another year beyond 2013, it would come at a cost of $6.1 billion over 10 years. And so there are many people that are asking, and the industry is asking themselves, sort of what next? What's the next best policy step? And in looking through testimony provided last week and reviewing materials and information, it seems as though many are resigned to the fact that there will be a gradual phase out of the federal production tax credit. And you know, one idea is to potentially replace that tax credit over time with other financing mechanisms that are enjoyed by other energy industries like oil and gas and coal. And so master limited partnerships and real estate investment trusts are two of the ideas as far as incentives or policies that the federal government could have in place long term to replace the production tax credit for wind. And obviously wind faces other issues. Transmission needs, we know that we're constrained exporting more than 60% of the electricity that we generate here in North Dakota. So transmission, you know, both at a state, regional, and national level is a concern. We have an aging grid, and there's lots of issues with that. Wind is an intermittent resource. Obviously the wind doesn't blow all the time, and so storage is also a need and an issue long term. And development. I think Justin talked about one of the issues of the Pipeline Authority with, you know, strengthening landowner relations is one of the biggest tasks. And there's a lot of landowner fatigue, I think, around the state. And so we expect to see increasing landowner rights types issues just with all development, as landowners are sort of hit over the head with all sorts of requests for rights of way and other things. Switching gears just a little bit, I was asked to talk about wind and other renewables, and ethanol obviously is probably the other largest renewable energy sector in North Dakota. We have four operating ethanol plants at the moment: Richardson, Hankinson, Castleton, and Underwood. And according to the North Dakota Ethanol Council, an economic impact of more than $300 million annually. The average wage for a job in that industry is more than $64,000. And, you know, looking at the map showing wind projects in 18 counties, each of these plants, ethanol plants, is locating in a community that has a population of 2,500 people or less. So ethanol is doing a lot of good things for the state of North Dakota. We've seen a tenfold increase in production since 2005. And utilizing a lot of corn, 140 million bushels of corn a year, that will increase to 165 million bushels of corn once the Dakota Spirit Ag Energy Project comes online in about 18 months or so. And beyond utilizing the corn, we're also producing DDGs, or 18 pounds of livestock feed, from each bushel of corn that's processed in an ethanol facility. Beyond wind and ethanol, biomass is also another resource. We plant between 20 and 22 million acres of crops in North Dakota each year. There are a lot of residual materials, wheat straw, corn stover, that can be utilized in biomass applications. We are ranked first in the potential for energy crops, not just residues, but in the production of energy crops for biomass. I'll talk about GRE's Dakota Spirit Ag Energy Project in just a moment, and Spiritwood Station is kind of an example of biomass going forward. But as you can see from the slide, there are other good things happening with respect to biomass around the state as well. And I'm going to jump ahead and then jump back. So Dakota Spirit Ag Energy, they broke ground on a 65 million gallon ethanol facility, corn ethanol facility, in August. is adjacent to the Spiritwood Station, their combined heat and power plant, and had the pleasure of working with Great River Energy on this project for a couple of years. And actually, at the outset, they were looking at the construction of a cellulosic ethanol refinery using wheat straw, and then they modified that to wheat straw and corn stover, given the shift in where wheat straw and the decline in wheat acres altogether. And what they ended up concluding and deciding to do was to construct a corn ethanol facility, and their interesting part, or one of the many interesting features of this project, is they're using process steam from Spiritwood Station. So they're building in efficiencies into their standard ethanol project, if you will, but their plant design will allow for bolt-on technologies on the front end of the plant to incorporate, you know, potentially the processing of wheat straw and corn stover or another biomass material. Energy beets have been talked about. There's a wide range of things they can do, but they've been very strategic about how they're constructing the plant so that the balance of plant can be utilized to focus on some next generation types of projects on the front end as well. Looking at DSA from the standpoint of a conventional corn ethanol plant and then adding wheat straw and corn stover on, they'd be looking at adding 10 million gallons of production if they did phase two with corn stover and wheat straw. And then they would be producing corn oil, DDGs, and also lignin. And the lignin would actually be then sent back across the road. They can co-fire up to 10% biomass in the boilers at Spiritwood Station. So this is an example of traditional energy and renewable energy working together, finding a lot of synergies and efficiencies, and I think a really good model for all of us to look at. And back to just a minute on ethanol again and flex fuel pumps. In 2012, North Dakota led the nation in the number of flex fuel pumps per capita. I'm sure you've all seen the variety of stickers on the pumps at gas stations. So we have 221 pumps installed statewide. And in 2011, North Dakota had record E85 sales. And the Ethanol Council and others just announced last week there are, I think, six E15 pumps that are available at PetroServe USA stations around the state. Now, even with all of that in place, based on the ethanol we produce, we're only consuming 8% of the ethanol that we're producing in North Dakota here in state. The rest is being railed or shipped elsewhere. And so in summary, North Dakota is blessed with an abundance of resources. We sort of have it all here, fossil, renewable, and agricultural resources. And so we certainly have the opportunity to capitalize on all of those fronts and help lead the U.S. to energy independence, maybe sooner than 2035. Thank you.
Hey. Patrice, I'd like to go back to the slide where it says the future of federal wind policy, and you were talking about there's two mechanisms, replaced financial mechanisms similar to other industries. Wind doesn't have those now. The master limited partnership and the real estate investment trust.
Not that I'm aware of. With the real estate investment trust, it's my understanding that the IRS could essentially make a ruling on its own without congressional action mm-hmm. to allow wind to be eligible for that. The master limited partnership issue, though, would require a congressional act to include wind.
Okay, I'm surprised they don't have these mechanisms. But okay, anybody else have any questions? Senator Murphy.
Quick one, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Patrice, what's lignin?
So how to explain it? I mean, basically, it's basically compressed into a pellet, the lignin of the residue material.
After the sugars are done.
Yeah. Sorry for that very non-scientific answer.
Anyone else have any questions? Comments? Senator Triplett.
Just one, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lalum, you mentioned, as I've seen mentioned elsewhere, that China leads the world in investments in some of these pollution control devices and such. And I read somewhere recently, and I'm sorry, but I can't remember where, that while they apparently have required investments on coal plants and such for pollution control systems, that they don't enforce the use of them. So they're installed, but like not being used was the suggestion. Do you have any insight in that, if that's accurate?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Triplin, I'm sorry, I don't. I'd be happy to look into it and get back to you directly, though.
Okay. Representative Damshin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess following up a little bit on that same slide and question, who do you have information on who is actually producing the largest amount of energy at the least rate of pollution or cleanest production? Any of those countries that would have information on?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Damshin, I haven't seen anything specifically. Again, I'd be happy to look for material and provide back to the committee. But in the charts that and information that I've come across, I haven't seen it specifically spelled out that way.
If you could come up with something, I'd be interested in.
Sure.
And if you would get it to Mr. Dawson, and he'll get it out to the committee members. Okay. Anything else? Well, thank you very much for your information and report. Thank you. Our next agenda item is 3:45, and at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Dawson. He's been sitting here doing busy work, and now we're going to make him work some more.
Chairman Wardner, committee members, you should have the first draft of a bill draft before you, number 22.01. The primary purpose of having this bill draft today is to get it out here into the public domain so people can comment on it at a different meeting. I haven't asked anybody to come at this time and comment on it. I hope you'll see that as you look at the bill draft before you that most of it, if not all of it, is permissive in nature. The idea is to allow a board of county commissioners to work with the State Department of Transportation to transfer maintenance of a road over to the Department of Transportation. The bill reads, the Board of County Commissioners may make written application to the Director of the Department of Transportation to have the maintenance of a highway permanently or temporarily transferred to the Director based on a number of factors then listed. The Director may approve the application and place conditions on the approval. If the transfer is temporary, the Director shall require the county to pay on a yearly basis the cost of maintenance to the State Highway Fund. If the transfer is permanent, the Director may require the county to pay all, part, or none of the cost. If the transfer is permanent, the highway is part of the State Highway System, notwithstanding the limitations on mileage in a calendar year, which is 50 miles, and total mileage, which is 7,700 miles, or percentage of road in the state, which is 7% by other statutory provisions. If the transfer is on a temporary basis, the highway remains part of the county road system. I think I'll conclude.
Okay, any comments from anyone? It's a someone asked for this bill draft, and it's just out there to get input from people. Does anybody here want to make any comments on this? I did get some input from a county commissioner in Dunn County, and basically his concerns were, you better check this out before you do it. Could be a lot of responsibility on the state, and then they're concerned about the response when there are roads that need attention, the time that the state would get to there to take care of that concern. So that kind of sums it up. But so if anybody has any comments, we'll take them now. If not, we'll let you percolate on it. Pardon? Of that bill?
It should be in your packet or with your stuff there someplace.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Andrews?
Is, my interest, I think it's a good idea. We tried to get the highway turnover to the city a few years ago, and, but we found the transportation department, they're just giving lip service to showing some interest in studying it before they rejected it. So my question is, we can allow people to apply for this, but is there any indication that the highway department might consider it?
Well,
they've been very reluctant over the years to take on additional mileage.
Right. And I think that this legislation would probably change how they viewed that. I would like to make this comment to the committee is that now that we have the Upper Great Plains Transportation Institute doing studies across the state, not just in oil country, but also in all over the state, I think we have a much better handle on our roads, county, township, but basically the county. And, you know, because we do have resources, I think the state is committed to making sure that we have good roads in the state. So I see that as we move forward, whether it's a county or state road, we're going to try to get it taken care of if it's necessary and needed for commerce in that particular area. All right, we're going to move on. Any persons here that have any comments that they would like to make? Well, I'd like to keep it to energy. I don't want to get on anything else. All right. If not, committee members, we're going to reconvene at 7:55 tomorrow morning. And could you tell us where we should be?
Chairman Warder, committee members, at 7:55, hopefully we'll meet for 1 or 2 minutes to call the place to order and then recess and go to the 2013 Great Plains Empower North Dakota Conference. After it's over, we'll get together again and talk about it a little bit and then adjourn. The meeting itself will be on the third floor of the National Energy Center of Excellence at BSC. I'm from Bismarck, so I want to call it BJ or something else. Anyway, it's on the third floor, and I think it's on pretty far south in the campus, and about as far west as you can get to. If you jump out the back of it, you'd land in the river. So,
all right, and you can see we're in room 335. If not, and we won't when we meet in the afternoon, we won't hopefully won't have a long time because I know most of you don't want to be headed home. So with that, Representative Porter.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if everybody pre-registered for this, but there was a email that went out from Mr. Dawson that you should have done. If not, you might want to talk to him in order to get the registration in so that they know you're coming. And then as far as our dress code for tomorrow, Mr. Chairman?
Business casual.
Like my business or my
business? No, I think you look pretty good the way you are.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, this reminds me when I was coaching basketball. You have to tell the guys you got to dress up when you go to the ball games. And they didn't want to wear a sports coat and tie. Now I got to tell you that.
Well, I was the same guy then.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just like Yogi Berra says, deja vu all over again, only in a different place. All right. We're digressing. All right. We're going to be in recess till tomorrow morning at 7:55. Breakfast at 7:30.
This is kind of an interesting chart.
Yeah, it is.
Now look at how high the price was. Well, this is value, you know, 1980.
Look at this past year.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
then they had that incentive program where if you drilled the new well, that was worth $5 a barrel. And when I showed you where they're drilling that new Tyler well, we had one right north of there, too. That was a $3 well. They always drilled the well across the road. That was a $5 well. Guess what happened to our well? It went to hell in hell. Yeah. The thing was, it was the tanks would be full, and then they'd be empty. You know, and the crank was never going around. And we said, what the hell's going on here? Well, it's broke down. It's broke down. So one time my girlfriend and I were coming back from the movie, you know, and it was a moonlit night, and all the lights were turned off. And I went by and that sucker's going around. I call it the midnight bumper, you know, they'd pump it at night when nobody could see. And then they would move the oil over to another thing.
Oh. Our strategic planning did it.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
So you guys wouldn't be the first
one. Yeah. Why that the governor and Congress did it.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know that we can do that. We've always made decisions sometimes it's paper DOT for some people because something like that.
We chose not to do that. I thought you were for it. Comes up with the I think we have that.